Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talked to Stephen Bush and George Eaton about the Labour leadership race and the fallout from the Lib Dems' annihilation in the election. Then Anna Leskowitz, Barbara Speed and I talk about female-focused comedy and drama. So it's a week on from the general election and the dust has somewhat settled. The post-mortems are, if not finished, then certainly well underway. And I'm joined by our political editor, George Eaton, and our Staggers editor, Stephen Bush, to look to the future. So, George, tell us where we are with the Labour leadership contenders.
Yes, so it was the Blair-esque reformists who were the first out of the blocks, the Weekend, Chukka and Liz Kendall. And they've now been joined by Andy Burnham and Yvette Cooper, who both declared their candidacies last night. It doesn't look as if Tristram Hunt's going to run now, but the rumour that he might has allowed him at least to float some of his policy
ideas. And what about Owen, I'm going to say Smith.
Yes, the Shadow Welsh Ken Nice have started doing the Who Are You Backing calls. And there was a surprising level of, I'd actually quite like Owen Smith to run. Someone who's more sort of from the left of the party is quietly considered very impressive. He's highly rated by lots of Labour insiders, including, of course, the incredibly influential editor of Labour List, Mark Ferguson. But one, the fact that Ian Lavery from the left is throwing his weight behind Andy Burnham suggests his path to 35 MPs is going to be quite difficult. And two, I'm told, he does have small children. Like Dan Jarvis, he's sort of perhaps willing to wait. But he was, I was surprised at how much chatter about him there was over the weekend.
Isn't that fascinating? I think that was the same thing with Dan Jarvis. We're now at the state where male politicians with young children think that politics is incompatible with a kind of family life. Like, basically, you can't be a good dad and be a politician just as hard as people have found it to be a good mum and a politician.
Yeah, it's kind of...
I blame feminism.
Yeah, I mean, I blame feminism too. I think hopefully it's sort of a positive interim stage where people start going, this is difficult for me as well. And maybe then there's a third stage when people go, well, does it need to be this difficult? Because actually, sort of, one of my many takes on what Ed Miliband did wrong is this high intensity staying up until the latest hours approach seems a bit unnecessary when you are the opposition.
And you're 5 years out.
You're 5 years out. You actually can save your energy, partly because tired, stressed people who don't see their family enough make bad decisions. CF the Edstone, CF most of the decisions taken by Team Miliband over the last 5 years. And so you kind of hope that maybe the next Labour leader might actually feel confident enough to go, do you know what? I'm in opposition. I've got small children. We're going to work 10 to 6.
And also, I talked to somebody from Parley Gender, which is one of the things that one of the groups that set up to kind of deal with gender issues in Parliament. And they said that actually there's been quite a lot of MPs who suggested that they could job share, but it's just been absolutely, like, I think Sarah Williston maybe is one of them, who have said, actually you could, an MP is a job that you could do, both of you could do 2.5 days a week, particularly as in all job shares, everyone always ends up doing more time than they're actually contracted to. There are definitely things you could do to make Parliament more family-friendly. Sorry, that was just a personal segue. So George, is that now looks like that is the field then, the field of four?
Yes, I mean, it's who knows if there'll be any late entrants. It seems unlikely at the moment. But of those, Andy Burnham is clearly in a very strong position. He would have been in a strong position on a short timetable because he's one of the best known as someone who was health secretary and then shadowed the brief in opposition. And the longer timetable will also benefit him because he's likely to win the most trade union endorsements, and the main unions now have more time to sign up their members. Under the new voting system, he gave the best received speech at last year's Labour conference. So he is in a strong position.
But on the downside for him, actually the NHS, which was kind of considered to be Labour's biggest weapon in the election, didn't turn out to perhaps sway that as many votes as they hoped.
No, but I think it was interesting when he launched his bid in his video message, he didn't give his sort of standard stump speech, in a way he doesn't need to do that, because those Labour activists who love the NHS more than anything, and for whom that's their number one issue, are going to already be backing him. So he's got to broaden his appeal, and I thought he did that quite well in his opening video.
And Stephen, who do you think Yvette Cooper's kind of natural support core within the party will be?
I mean, I think that's actually her problem. Her natural support core is MPs, which is, you know, obviously was hugely useful under the old Electoral College, but actually the support of 100-odd MPs doesn't really mean anything under the new one-member, one-vote system. The thing I found really interesting is there are lots of MPs who are backing her, very few parliamentary staffers who are backing her, and even fewer just ordinary activists who, you know, you phone up and go, sorry about the result, to a constituency chair. And they go, oh, who are you backing? And I go, oh, what's Yvette done? You know, so I think Yvette is almost a decoy frontrunner in some ways. She's an immense heavyweight. So to get on my Metropolitan Liberal high horse, I found it immensely frustrating that someone who's been an ever-present on the Labour front bench, who's been an MP since 1997, and the first role she talked about in her memoirs was, says, I'm in politics as a mum. And it's just like, well, you're not, because you became a mum in 1999, at which point you'd been in politics for 2 years as an MP and some years before that as a SPAD. It's one of those things where it's just like, on the one hand, you know, the unkind explanation for this is a very clever way of going, not Chucker, not Andy, and not Liz, who doesn't have children. And the other way is going, it's like, really, as a mom, are we still, is that the position
we're at? It's a bit American, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a bit kind of like, speaking as a mother, and I'm surprised, actually, because if there's one thing that I think I would give Yvette credit for, it's that she is incredibly disciplined, and the advantage of her as a candidate is that she's just, you know, I think you just feel like a high level of competence radiates off her, like you just feel like she would just turn out every day, she would get things, that, you know, she would be intensely reliable. And actually, if you look at someone like Theresa May or Nicola Sturgeon or Angela Merkel, there is a big market in politics for people who aren't necessarily kind of giving off huge amounts of fireworks and wild charisma. But you fundamentally kind of think, well, things won't get worse. Definitely, they'll just turn up and do a really good job. So Chucker's Facebook video to launch his campaign, Stephen, I know you weren't a massive fan.
It was one of those things where I looked at it and I just thought, either this was done in one take, which is an odd decision, or it wasn't done in one take, in which case
it was an odd decision.
It was an odd decision not to keep doing more takes. It was not very good. It was kind of sort of fairly hokey, which, I mean, Isabel Harden at The Spectator has suggested was a deliberate decision to, you know, to get rid of the slick image. I think, actually, if you're Chucker Amuna, one of your great strengths is you're slick, you're charismatic, you're a bit of glam. And actually, I suspect, after the 5 years the country's about to have, a bit of glam will not be that bad, particularly considering that none of the likely contenders to replace Cameron now are going to be that glamorous. It's not going to be Boris, who will, you know, be ancient by the time David Cameron steps down. Sorry, Bojo. Yeah, I was surprised at how rubbish the video was. Although the content was great and the messaging, the optics of going to Swindon where Labour got gubbed, was bang on.
I've literally never heard that word before.
Gubbed? That's, yeah.
What having the young people involved in the podcast brings a whole new lingo, as I believe you call it. George, I just want to quickly talk about the Lib Dems. I wrote my column this week saying basically, you know, do you miss them yet? The premise of which being that I think a lot of people voted because they thought the coalition wasn't that bad. You know, they liked the continuity. They thought the economy was getting better. They felt that we were on the right course and they would just like to stay on that course. As it turns out, they're not on the same course. You know, we now have a lot of kind of fairly full-blooded right-wingers in the cabinet. The two I mentioned were Michael Gove at Justice, who can't resist kind of turning everything into a kind of great battle. And now his deputy Dominic Raab, who has said some things that, like, he's called feminists bigots and said that men should burn their briefs because in some ways they were the most depressed. I don't know whether or not he'll bring any of that to justice, but there we go. Priti Patel has previously said that capital punishment is an effective deterrent. I'm sure I could go on with. There was a kind of great spectacle of people trying to slightly disavow things that they previously said. So Caroline Dinnage, who's now Equalities Minister, previously voted against gay marriage, and she did a kind of tweet going like, "Oh, of course I'm in favour of gay marriage. I love equalities." And you're like, "Well, you know, the reason that we all got the opinion that you weren't was because of your voting record." Do you think that overall the modernisers have not capitalised on Cameron's victory, basically?
I think it's been a victory for the blue-collar modernisers. So those who think the original phase of modernisation focused too much on liberal issues. Yes, climate change, gay rights, sort of liberal social justice policy, hoodies. And what actually the Tories needed to do is to rebrand themselves as the party of sort of hard workers, of the strivers, rather than as the party of the rich. And there was definitely elements of that to the election campaign. So the pledge to take anyone earning the minimum wage out of tax, the pledge actually to put $8 billion in the NHS, to 33 hours of childcare.
And there's also the fact that Robert Halfen, who is Jason's favourite MP, the MP for where our editor Jason Cowley grew up in Harlow, he's long been a kind of champion of kind of, you know, like you say, blue collar conservatism. He's now deputy chair of the party.
That's right, yeah.
Underneath Lord Feldman, who funded the last campaign, which is, helps your ambitions in that regard, I think. But what about the kind of sort of almost Britannia Unchained kind of wing of the party? Is that an olive branch to them? And B, are they going to snap the olive branch off and poke Cameron in the eye with it in about 6 months?
Well, Cameron has had to manage his own internal coalition in this reshuffle. So whereas before it was all about keeping Nick Clegg and Danny Alexander on side, now it's about keeping Graham Brady, the chair of the 1922 committee, the Tories' backbench grouping, happy, keeping the Eurosceptics happy. It will need work, but at the moment, you know, Cameron walks on water. I mean, he's the first Prime Minister since John Major in 92 to win a, first Conservative leader since John Major in 92 to win a majority. He will need to pay greater attention to his party, but I think the first year or so will be okay, but the test will come when there is this EU referendum, and there's a hardcore group of about 60 Tory MPs who aren't going to be satisfied with anything that Cameron can conceivably bring back from Brussels. And there will be a split there. And one big test will be, does Cameron act as Harold Wilson did the last time we had an EU referendum in 1975 and suspend collective responsibility, allow members of his cabinet to vote against EU membership?
It's funny, isn't it? Making it like essentially an issue of conscience.
Yes.
Like capital punishment or abortion or something like that. Well, it doesn't quite, for me, fall into that category, but I guess it does for some Tories. Stephen, I saw you looking mildly sceptical during that.
I mean, I think, yeah, there are already issues coming down the pipe where that very fragile coalition he now has looks a bit wobbly to me. The ECHR and the Human Rights Act, where actually, you know, without wishing to be cruel to the quality of lawyer than they have as Attorney General now, most of the first-rank lawyers within the Conservative Party are sceptical about the value of repealing the Human Rights Act and getting out of the European Court of Human Rights. You only need to find 8 Conservative MPs who vote against that, and suddenly you're having to offer stuff to the DUP, and the stuff they offer is completely divergent with things the Tory right actually wants. You know, 12 is not a large majority at all. And it's very easy to see, I think, how, having effectively rewarded the Tory right, there are already some people who are kind of...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Classic Cameron allies who are already saying, well, where's my promotion? What did I get for this? Where are the people who stayed loyal? I think that they will do a much better job of advertising for the Lib Dems than the Lib Dems did. but two, I think even within this first year, we may begin to start to see the beginnings of pitched battles between bits of the Tory party.
Well, on that pessimistic or optimistic, depending on your point of view, prediction, I'll say thank you very much to George and Stephen. Well, in the NS office, we've been vastly appreciating the comedy of Amy Schumer, who is an American comedian who pursues an explicitly feminist agenda with her comedy. I'm pausing there because I'm aware that for some listeners, they will think, oh, feminism, that's not very funny, is it? But no, they are wrong. And you are, we're going to prove that you're wrong by telling you exactly why feminism is taking over comedy. I'm joined by our writers, Barbara Speed and Anna Leskowitz. First of all, Anna, describe to me why you like Amy Schumer.
So she's been in the media a lot more lately. She's got a new show called Inside Amy Schumer that's been doing quite well in sort of a primetime slot in the States. She pursues an explicitly feminist agenda in her comedy. A lot of it is about women's issues like rape culture, representation on TV, but it somehow escapes being sober, preachy in any way. She's very self-aware and often makes herself the brunt of the joke when it's not the patriarchy. It escapes, being too in your face, telling you what to think.
So to talk about a couple of the one that I watched of her sketches this morning, she does a very funny parody of what it's like to be an actress appearing on a late night talk show. So basically, you kind of come on in your like little tiny dress and your very shiny oiled legs, and sit down, kind of going like, and then you basically have to just sort of endure the host kind of slightly low-level sleazing over you for 5 minutes when he goes, doesn't she look amazing? She looks amazing. Doesn't she look amazing? Oh, I wish I could murder my wife. You look so amazing. And while you kind of, like, as the starlet, kind of has to sort of sit there and kind of go, ha, 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 great. And then kind of do like that phrase that was coined that was really influential from Gillian Flynn's novel Gone Girl, this idea of the cool girl, which I think is something that's really kind of come to have a lot of cultural currency. So the kind of the idea behind the cool girl is this is somebody who is much like Ariel Levy's idea of female chauvinist pigs. It's somebody who is totally hot and totally amazing. You know, she chows down hot dogs with the guys, but mysteriously is still always a size 8. It's somebody who is both simultaneously incredibly feminine, but not all the negative stereotypes you associate with femininity. So she's not kind of whiny and she's not always kind of going on about her diet. She just is thin. You know, she absolutely loves everything to do with sex. She's never complaining about her feelings. You know, she's always up for it.
I think that's really what's so great about her as well, is that you get the sense that with the cool girl, she's like, been there, done that. I've tried being the cool girl. I've tried being the girl who cares about her diets. I've tried being the girl who like laughs at the sleazy jokes, and essentially none of them really very satisfying. And yeah, she's just very good at like making you feel like she's in on the joke, we're all in on the joke.
But also I think it's more than that. Is that so one of my favourite kind of comedians from the, I guess, late 90s, now this is how old I am, you won't remember this person, but early 2000s, is a guy called Dave Chappelle, who was an American comedian, he was black, and he did a lot of humour that was specifically directed towards black audiences. And he actually eventually, one of the reasons that contributed to him leaving, and he went and lived in, I think, South Africa for a while, he sort of basically stormed out of show business, was that he was really worried about the fact that were white people laughing at his jokes in a kind of, in an ironic way? When he was kind of reworking stereotypes in a kind of ironic way, were people getting that level of irony? But he wanted to make comedy. He wanted, as a black comedian, he wanted to make comedy specifically for a black community. And when I watched Amy Schumer, I kind of feel that this is for us, right? This is comedy for women. I don't know. What do you think, Barbara? Do you think that men will find it as funny?
I think there's a danger, you're right, that the irony might lose a level with some people, not necessarily just men. But I think that it definitely resonates most with women, because there was like a really good phrase used to describe her comedy as it's about kind of the desperation that masks itself as freedom. So it's like the way women act to kind of seem really free and chill and cool. And I think for women that will definitely resonate the most. But I also think that men might recognise, like, I mean, in the sketch you mentioned, there's like the actress's legs just keep getting like shinier and shinier.
Until they get gold, basically, yeah. At the end,
and
they're so shiny.
In another sketch she did, like, she's a football coach's wife, and she just is holding like an ever-growing glass of wine in each scene. And like, that is objectively funny, because that is exactly how, like, and she just says all the stock phrases that those women in films say.
And there's another one that I thought was the one that kind of, I think, really launched her for British audiences was the, I can't, for fear of losing our clean rating on the Apple podcasting, I would say it's the idea of your last bleepable day. So she's got Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Tina Fey, And they're all celebrating the fact that, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus has had a really good run, but she's now in her 50s and basically no one will want to employ her anymore. And what I thought about that was that I thought that marked a certain amount of change, because actually when you look at women like that, they are now at a stage where, you know, Tina Fey can get something made, right? She can, not only is she a star in front of the camera, so Unbreakable, Kimmy Schmidt, she's the executive producer on, you know, she's now a player in the sense. I think that maybe is the change, is that there are enough women who want to push that agenda who are now in kind of creative roles. So it's not just that you get cast as a sort of feisty front woman for something, or even, you know, you're a stand-up comic who is basically a freelancer and you just build your own audience around it, that actually there have been people who have succeeded within the system.
And it's telling that they're often the producer, the writer, the director, the star, all of those things at once, and it almost seems like you need that.
And you need to be friends with Judd Apatow.
Yeah, he's like randomly the godfather
who's suddenly become like the king somehow of the feminists.
Yeah.
But is there anyone else that you think is doing the kind of things that Amy Schumer is doing, Anna?
Definitely. I think one of the things I like about her specifically is that she also has that edge of just like going into the surreal. So like the weird like wine glass ever growing. I love at the end of the last Bleepable Day, they just put...
They put Julie Louis-Dreyfus on a boat and it looks like they're about to set fire to it, like a Viking funeral.
Send it out into like a river that seems to be going nowhere. It's just really weird and funny. Broad City has that edge to it, which is a comedy about two girls living in New York who are best friends, but it's sort of as far away from girls as really you can get in that quite specific genre of comedy.
Of comedy about women in New York.
Yeah. But yeah, it often... bizarre things will happen. There'll be like a dance scene. They've got this whole sort of approach to New York that's really like semi-fictional and surreal and very bizarre.
But do you think any of that does? I mean, Girls for All, it's incredibly, you know, generation of op-eds and controversy. One of my favourite tweets ever is the "Happy Girls Think Piece Season, everyone," which is, you know, for the viewing figures that it got, like Mad Men, it generated a huge amount of kind of cultural conversation. That because of what Lena Dunham did with that, is she depicted herself looking really kind of like dumpy, like deliberately she shot herself in really unflattering ways when she's not a hideous woman by any means. That's the big change, is that actually there is now a market for women looking a bit stupid and not looking, you know.
But I think also what's interesting is that compared to Schumer or to Broad City, Girls is quite somber and quite, it's not a laugh a minute, it's actually quite sad. And I think it's interesting that it sort of broke the turf and then now it's almost paved the way for slightly more joyful, more irreverent things that don't have to answer to questions about like, oh, why are these women being so weird? it was the first one, and I think maybe that's why it's imperfect, because it burst onto the scene of like things about men doing jobs. And
yes, that it got made at all was a kind of a miracle. Never mind. But that's so Emily Nussbaum from the New Yorker wrote a brilliant piece about Amy Schumer, and one of the things that she said about it is, you know, about this idea about doing feminist comedy that very much sells itself as feminist comedy. It's not sort of stealthily or sort of snuck in there. Is that when you are put on a pedestal, everyone tries to look up your skirt, and the backlash is coming. Mm. And what form do you think it will take?
It's so hard to say. I think one of the trends almost that we're seeing in this, like, comedies that are explicitly kind of female focused, is you start off with sort of very pretty comedians who can make it, and then you get, you know, people like Melissa McCarthy and Rebel Wilson coming in who can make it and don't have to conform to a certain look, and then you get people who can just be very, very silly and playful. So I think whatever the backlash is, it's just a line in the sand saying, well, actually, we've made it a certain way.
But also I think just that these comedies now are almost able to be for women without having to be just like trying to redefine the cultural space. And so in a way, the backlash can only be quite limited if it's men being like, oh, but women aren't funny though. Like that's it. That loses,
I suppose, that
some
is
of
the
its luster.
Post kind of Girls thing is that no one is ever going to say that any show should try and represent all of human female experience.
Yeah,
but my worry about it is, you know, looking at kind of countdowns of really great comedy shows, one of the ones that often comes up is Roseanne. And that was, you know, that was very much Roseanne Barr's kind of initial sort of genius and drive. She was the driving or kind of auteur behind that, really. And it was interesting because it portrayed a very obviously kind of working class provincial family who were, you know, didn't live vastly exciting, glamorous lives. You know, they went kind of bowling and had arguments in the supermarket. And then since then, it's been hard to see another Roseanne coming through. And my worry is that you kind of, when anything becomes fashionable or and it spawns some imitators, and then it's done. And that will be like, we will get 2 years of this and things that we commissioned off the back of it being successful. And then it'd be like, oh, well, but yeah, no, like, women aren't, you know, everyone's done funny women. Like, let's go back to something else. I don't know whether or not that, maybe that's an overly depressive view.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm just quite heartened by the range of people you're seeing. Like, a couple of recent independent films were really good and they were really building on what Girls did, I think, but in a really different way. So Appropriate Behaviour was, again, about a young woman, and she was going through a breakup, but she was bisexual and Iranian, which brought in loads of like other issues, and I think actually gave it a bit more depth than Girls had. And then there was Obvious Child, which was like the abortion comedy, as it became known. But again, that had a lot of backlash in the States because of its subject matter. But then I also think the next thing about abortion will have an easier time because we're kind of pushing forward.
And talking about kind of female focusings, you saw Girlhood, didn't you? Which
yeah,
is not the sequel to Boyhood.
No. It was basically looking at one girl's experience in a very deprived area of the Parisian suburbs, and her kind of attempts, I guess, to get out of it. Would you agree?
Yeah, in really unorthodox ways. I feel like things about the Paris suburbs, you feel like they're meant to be about how you go to the straight and narrow and you move into Paris and you become a middle-class person. And that's she basically joins a gang as a way of gaining independence. And the film just does it in a really good way, and it's incredibly non-judgmental. And it's just kind of about how people try and deal with their situations.
Yeah, you're neither like, we don't want her to like resort to petty crime. And you're also not like, this is a great thing, we're so excited for her that she's found friends in this gang. It's like somewhere between those two things. You don't want her to make life more difficult for herself by getting in trouble, but you also recognise that this has been weirdly very empowering for her. So the fact that you can make films that are like that nuanced when it comes to female experience is obviously an achievement.
Well, it's a rare burst of optimism from the New Statesman podcast as we go, maybe things are getting better. More misery next week. But for the moment, thank you, Barbara and Anna. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.